G'day mate, how you going? This is Lethal Mullet here tonight to look at the classic Streets of Fire. It's a rock and roll fable. One, of course, directed by Walter Hill, starring, of course, Michael Paré, Diane Lane, Rick Moranis, Amy Madigan, and many others. And, of course, even our pal, Willem Dafoe. That's right, Willem Dafoe's in this, and Rick Rossovic and many others, folks. We'll look at that tonight. Of course, directed by the great, of course, Walter Hill, and, of course, produced by Lawrence Gordon and Joel Silver. Folks, this was a classic, and it's one that's very hard to find, one that I was not able to find on VHS back in the day, but was on TV a number of times. Walter Hill's classic, Streets of Fire.
I'm sitting here waiting, contemplating what's the best day. Watching that movie, I'm the lethal moment. Wow, I'm the lethal. Wow, I'm the lethal. Oh, I'm the lethal.
Well, thank you. Welcome back to the show, folks. Here we're going to be looking at Streets of Fire. And before I get into it, huge thanks to a mate of mine in the UK who said there was a new edition out of Walter Hill's film. And of course, I'm a huge fan of Walter Hill, have been for years. And one of the biggest things about that is the fact that, you know, I've got all of his stuff, but Streets of Fire is the one that's eluded me for years. Knew what it was about, knew about the cast. And it is one of his more polished films, even though it was done on a back lot and definitely is atmospheric for what it is. It's definitely an interesting cast and a great sort of mythic story. You know, this is his Star Wars to a certain extent. You know, it's a Western done in a kind of timeless society, because that's what it's sort of looking at. It's a great little piece of Americana, if anything. And it's great to have the sort of gunslinger that's coming home from the war to kind of get things going. So let's give you an idea of what this is all about. Big-time rock star Ellen Aim is playing her hometown when she is grabbed from the stage by local bike gang the Bombers, led by the menacing Raven. Tom Cody, a tough ex-soldier and Ellen's ex-boyfriend, returns home to get her back and is ready to take on the whole gang. So it is one of those sort of timeless classic stories of rescue and revenge and all that sort of stuff. And it's all about the people that you meet along the way, you know, mercenaries, managers, all that sort of stuff. And, you know, you've got some really interesting talent on the side. So, folks, let's strap in, get into this, and enjoy this little slice of Walter Hill's past. And definitely probably his biggest when it comes to budgets and stuff like that. After, of course, 48 Hours really kicking it off. The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy has many a thing to say about deep thought. And deep thought itself has many a thing to say about the guide. But who are going to give you a guide through the maelstrom and enormity of the guide itself? Hosted by two unexpected travelers, the Lethal Mullet, all the way from Quinlan's Cantina in the Milky Way, and of course, Dan the Man from Birmingham. All on the other side of the water, they have hitched a ride and come to Ursa Minor. Tell you all about the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, which you can find whenever you find good podcasts.
That's right, folks. Check out the brand new show, Deep Thought Life, Douglas Adams and Everything, monthly on, of course, the Lethal Mullet Network at lethalmulletnetwork.podbean.com or on the socials at The Lethal Mullet. You can also check it out on YouTube very soon on the Spacebook Network, hosted by the one and the only co-host here, Dan the Man from Birmingham, Dan Hadley. All here. And don't panic, we'll be back.
Hi, this is Tom Caldwell from Good Evening, an Alfred Hitchcock podcast on the Fandom Podcast Network, inviting you to check out our show. Once a month, we release an episode about the films of the great master of suspense, Alfred Hitchcock. You can find us on Facebook at Hitchcock Good Evening, on Twitter at Good Evening Pod, and along with myself and Brandon Shea Mutala and Chris Haig, we bring you a fun and friendly show that you can enjoy alongside your viewing of the films of Alfred Hitchcock. On behalf of the program, I wish you good evening.
G'day, mate. How you going? Welcome to the Lethal Mullet Network, where you'll find all these amazing shows and more. Where you'll find the Lethal Mullet Podcast, a celebration of action cinema from the 80s, 90s, and beyond. You'll also find Making Treks, a Star Trek fan podcast, where I'm joined by my amazing co-host, Mark Newbold, into a deep dive of Star Trek. You can also find Mullet and Kilt, a look at music, where I'm joined by my dear pal, Darth Elvis, and where you can also find the Mullet Guild, a look at the Dune universe. All here on, of course, lethalmulletnetwork.podbean.com or on your favourite podcatcher. You can find us there. You can also find all these shows a week later on, of course, the one, the only Fandom Podcast Network, FPN, on fpnet.podbean.com. Don't forget to also follow us on socials. There's, of course, Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram at the handle at the Lethal Mullet. We'll catch you out there and enjoy your action cinema. Hi, mate, how you going? Come on in, mate. Yeah, yeah. What shall it be?
Oh, yeah. Man, it's been real busy, D, you know?
Right, mate.
Hey.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's just like I was telling my mate the other day, you know, have a nice, you know, cold beverage.
Here you go, mate. Here, enjoy this beverage and enjoy this film chat.
Tonight, we're going to be looking at the 1984 film by, of course, none other than Walter Hill. It is directed by him and, of course, co-written by Larry Gross. This is a massive film for the time, but it's also one of the great things about this is that it's a rock and roll fable. Now, what we mean by this, there's a lot of myth going on here. Obviously, there have been some great films by 1984. We had, obviously, the Star Wars trilogy and many other things just like that. And I think this was a chance for Walter to really stretch his own legs in something like this. I mean, I think, in particular, being such a, you know, well-known producer, director in his own right, and obviously, storyteller, this was his chance at really getting it out there. And definitely, I think, when it comes down to the story and stuff like that, is it just a classic Western, really, in what would be kind of a 1960s or maybe even a 1950s sort of era. As it says, it's another time, another place, right? So that's what's great thing about this story, right? We've got great stars in it. We've got Michael Paré, Diane Lane, Rick Moranis, Amy Madigan, Willem Dafoe, E.G. Daly, Deborah Van Valkenburgh as well. This is basically, it was a box office bomb, grossing only $8 million. And the film cost them $14.5 million to make at the time. But folks, you know, who knows what they were thinking at the time when it comes down to ticket sales and stuff like that. This film fires on all cylinders as far as I'm concerned. You know, this is great. This is really a vehicle for Michael Paré per excellence. It does a great job. This is a kind of film in the 50s they would have made with Marlon Brando, right? Somebody with a bit of attitude, bit of toughness and all that sort of stuff. And I love this. You know, it really is a great flick. Now, my own history with this is that I didn't get to see this till, I think it was TV in the late 2000s sometime, or the noughties. It would have been like 2008 maybe or something like that. It's just very hard to find back in the day. You couldn't find the DVD, let alone the Blu-ray out here in Australia, or at least here in Queensland. And it wasn't until this new edition, which is a UK edition, folks. It is their version of MA or 15 plus or whatever it is. And it's got a nice new artwork on the front. It says, "Tonight is what it means to be young. Streets of Fire, a rock and roll fable." And of course, it's got Diane Lane on the back cover and goes through all the different stuff that it's got on there. And it's from Universal Hollywood Classics Blu-ray disc from Second Sight UK. So www.secondsight.co.uk. Right, so folks, that's the one to check out if you want to get this new edition that I've found. You know, it's been here for a few years. It's 2013, this edition. So it's more than 10 years old. As we said at the start, this is obviously a bit of a fable. You know, it comes down to it. We'll replay it here. Big time rock singer Ellen Ames playing her hometown when she's kidnapped by a local gang called the Bombers and led to, of course, their bad, evil menace that leads them, of course, called Raven.
Tom Cody, who is, of course, Michael Paré's role, is a tough ex-soldier and Ellen's ex-boyfriend. He returns home to get her back, and he's ready to take on the entire gang. Now, this is a classic Western story, folks. This is what it appealed to me when I first saw it, and seeing it again now, so many years later, especially in glorious color that they've got on this Blu-ray. It's just, it is great. So it's written by Walter Hill and Larry Gross, produced by, of course, Larry Gordon and, of course, Joel Silver. Yes, producers of the 80s that gave us all those great films. We've talked about the cast already. We'll get into that a bit deeper a little bit later. Cinematography by Andrew Laszlo, edited by James Koblenz, Freeman A. Davies, and Michael Ripps. Music was by Ry Cooder, and it's hell good, folks. It's to me, this is on a par with Eddie and the Cruisers as far as like great soundtracks from that time. And that's one of my favourite soundtracks too, by the way. Production companies on this were Hill, Gordon, Silver Productions, and of course RKO Pictures. Distributed worldwide by Universal Pictures, and release date was in the United States, June 1, 1984. What a year, folks. We got The Last Starfighter that year too. Runtime of around about 93 minutes, and of course the budget was $14.5 million, and it only made $8.1 million back, so that makes it a box office bomb, as they call it in the industry. It's huge, the fact that this film did what it did, I guess, as well. Now, we've got a hell of a lot of cast here of aliens, Navy SEALs, this keeps going on, Uncle Buck. We've got Willem Dafoe, folks. I mean, who's been in just about everything, folks. McKelty Williamson's in this, Graham Bush. Yes, Balrog from, of course, Street Fighter. And, of course, one of the many special agents in, of course, Die Hard. We'll get to that in a sec. Robert Townsend as Lester. We've also got Bill Paxton as Clyde. Anyway, we'll get into this as we go through, but we know the main cast, but the fact that you got Rick Rossovic in this as one of the cops. We've got Richard Lawson in this as Ed Price, Bill Paxton as Clyde, Lee Ving as Greer. We've got Stoney Jackson as Bird, McKelty Williamson as BJ, Graham Bush as Reggie, Robert Townsend as Lester, and of course, E.G. Daly as Baby Doll. What a cast! I mean, from the 80s, this is, you know, when everyone was starting to really get into it. This is pre-Aliens too, folks. What a time. So the concept came together when they were making the film 48 Hours, and it reunited Walter Hill with Lawrence Gordon and Joel Silver, of course. And then with this new writer on the block there too, the screenwriter Larry Gross, whom they'd all worked together on the production. I guess 48 Hours was something that really started to fire up a lot of talent, didn't it? And I think one of the great things about this was to, you know, come up with an idea for a film that would appeal to, you know, not just the sort of action audience they already had. So the idea was that they wanted to make a film which was pretty much going to be like a comic book, right? According to Walter Hill, the idea was to make a film that was so perfect that it would be the kind of film he wanted to watch as a teenager. So he put all the kinds of things that he wanted. So he looked for custom cars, kissing in the rain, neon, trains in the night, high-speed pursuits, rumbles, rock stars, motorcycles, jokes in tough situations, leather jackets, and questions of honour. So all the sorts of things that, of course, would go into his movies later on as well. So one of those great things that we see. And, of course, he wanted to create, as he says, his own comic book movie that didn't have, of course, a comic book. And this is where Tom Cody came into being as the hero of the picture. So what the idea was, they were going to come up with something that was obviously, you know, inspired by a lot of the different things they were seeing at the time. One of the things that they looked at too was, as they were going through the time of 48 hours, they would get different ideas at the time. So one of those things is, in writing, Gross went through and basically had a diary. It was at the shoot of 48 hours, and from here he goes through, of course, also creating the universe that would be in, of course, Streets of Fire. So they're all different little ideas, and one of those things was to make it in the past, a little bit like George Lucas does, you know, in a galaxy long ago, all that sort of stuff. And that's where this sort of thing walks into that too. One of those other ones was, of course, hinting on things like the teen films of John Hughes, things like Rumblefish and The Outsiders as well, which were high school movies, basically. But they're also looking at more mythical stuff like Beauty and the Beast and things like that too. But there are also a little bit of violence involved in this too. And one of those things too is the fairy tales can be quite violent, is what Gross was getting alluding to there as well. And of course, it wouldn't be a movie the water Walter Hill has done that wasn't at least had some form of violence in the picture. Of course, this is no slouch in that department too. So the script was finished, they went to Paramount and they tried basically there to of course go through Walter's agent there, of course, with Larry Gordon and Michael Eisner, and they got into some kind of fight at the time when everything was finished up with the script and everything like too. And from there, they basically got rejected. So in that, they sold it to Universal. And Universal was the company that would put this one out there too. So where does the title of the film come from, right? Well, it comes from, of course, a song that's from Bruce Springsteen's 1978 album, Darkness on the Edge of Town. And one of those songs, obviously, alludes to the closing on that one, Streets of Fire. And it was basically the idea from that to get the idea of the title for the film. What an interesting cast, folks, too. I mean, how did they come about getting these up-and-coming talents at the time? So, they wanted to find a new Steve McQueen at the time, and this is, you know, going right back to the Magnificent Seven, and of course, even earlier. And they looked at everyone from Tom Cody for actors like Eric Roberts, Tom Cruise, and Patrick Swayze. Gross really wanted to see Tom Cruise and made him an offer, but he had already accepted another role at the time, wasn't able to do the film. But of course, Walter Hill had heard about, of course, Michael Paré, and he'd heard him through, of course, the agent that had said, look, check out Eddie Murphy for 48 hours. So this was a great part, obviously, on offer at the time. But of course, then he saw Paré in Eddie and the Cruisers and another one called Undercover, and that had not come out yet. And he looked at Paré in a quote, he said, he had the right quality, he was the only actor I found who was right for the part, a striking combination of toughness but innocence as well. So Paré said, he's someone who can come in and straighten everything out, that's the kind of character he's playing. And it's that mythical gunslinger, folks, it's the kind of role we all wish we were in life or were able to do, and I think that's what's really made it interesting this too. Ellen Aim was a character that they put together, basically was written to be a 28-year-old. And they wanted at the time splash actress Daryl Hannah to be in it. And from there, they just couldn't get a deal done in time. She was involved in other projects at the time, I guess. Diane Lane, though, read for her part, and she was 10 years younger than what was required. She was 18. But at the stage, you know, he even Walter Hill had thought she was too young for the role. But when he met her for the role and she auditioned for him in black leather pants, black mesh top and high heel boots. And from here, he said, well, you know, it really said rock and roll star for him. And then, of course, she had been in a lot of films because she was a child actress as well. So she had quite a bit of work done. 10 films. In fact, as well. So it's interesting to have that as well in the roles to drove through. Willem Dafoe, this is his first big film as well. And Catherine Bigelow was the one that actually recommended him to, of course, the production. And Bigelow was, at the time, dating David Giler, who was, of course, one of the many that helped out on the Aliens films as well. And, of course, he's a good friend of Walter Hill. And of course, they looked at Dafoe, and basically, even the writer Gross said may have been the best thing about their film is, of course, Willem. And look at Willem now. Obviously, he's probably out of all of that talent, the one that's still doing the most stuff, even to this day, with Spider-Man movies and, you know, art films, playing vampires, playing everything. And of course, he played a zombie, basically, out here, or vampire, out here in Daybreakers, which is a fantastic film. He is shot on the Gold Coast, folks. So, interesting stuff alone. So, obviously, as we said, the cast is you know, it's for itself there. You can see everyone was up and coming. Rick Moranis, who would go on to be such a staple of some of the 80s and 90s stuff, too, still working today. Spaceballs, probably one of my favourites.
Ghostbusters, and many others. But of course, we've also got Amy Madigan, who is always reliable. She plays McCoy in this. I think she does a really brilliant performance of playing somebody who's a reliable, tough pal, but also one that's there to help out when it's needed. And it's got that sort of real, I think, samurai quality to the role. We've got also Reva Cody, played by Deborah Van Valkenburg. We've also got, as we mentioned, Rick Rossovic in this. We're going to Terminator, obviously, along with Bill Paxton. And, obviously Navy SEALs as well, with Bill Paxton. And, of course, a different Michael joining them on those ones. Of course, Michael Biehn. It's interesting that they've all worked together so many times as well. Of course, we've got Granville Bush, who would go into, of course, playing Special Agent Johnson in Die Hard, one of the two, and many, many others involved. I mean, it is really, really interesting how these actors always cross paths. It's an interesting film. It was shot on location in Chicago in April 1983. And then from there, of course, they went to Los Angeles for 45 days and 2 weeks at the Soap Factory in Wilmington, California. And of course, filming at Universal Studios took place additionally as well. And all shooting was done. It was finished up and wrapped up in August 18, 1983. So, filming in Chicago were exteriors at nights, and of course, locations including platforms of the subway, things like Lower Wacker Drive there. The subways and their look was basically part and parcel of what they wanted to look at. Obviously, things like cars and motorcycles had to be part of those too. But of course, when you look at the look of it being sort of that industrial, rough 1950s Chicago look, that's what they wanted to really go for. And of course, part of that was the rundown cars and the 1940s stuff that they're looking at, and of course 1950s. And it gave it a sort of ethereal quality of being, from another time, another place. And of course, unfortunately, they're plagued with bad weather and stuff like that while they were shooting in Chicago. Things like hail, snow, rain, and of course all three together. Scenes were shot in LaSalle Street, which is on the Blue Line, Lake Street, the Green Line, Sheridan Road, and of course the Belmont Avenue and Damon Avenue as well. All of those were sort of brought together. So if you're in that area of Chicago, you'd understand obviously where they placed that in the film as well too. From there too, they had elevated train lines that were put in the back lot of Universal to sort of match what was happening in Chicago at the time as well. From there too, and that sort of brings that sort of obviously inner atmosphere back to where they were on the back lot too. And of course from there too, they've got all the different things that they were trying to do with obviously the bikes and stuff too in the same area. Exterior of the Richmond Theatre was where Ellen Ames sings at the beginning of the film, was shot on the back lot. And the interior was at the Willem Theatre in LA for 2 weeks. So they shot that, and of course, obviously, all the music and stuff like that too, they bring in too. From there too, obviously too, they had to light it a certain way. Andrew Laszlo shot the film with very low light through it and gave it sort of the low-tech, grungy quality that we had in the film. But I think it adds to it. That's, again, going back to that sort of 1950s feel. That's what they were going for, folks. That's what they were trying to bring into it too. So, and one of the things was, Walter Hill's got obviously different things he was aiming for to really give that sort of look that he was going for. Everything from the, even kind of the 1980s pop music videos that kind of look like that too. Walter Hill is quoted as saying he was humbled by the shoot, saying that, "I think I could have handled things and I didn't know how to shoot music. Music had been important in my life, in my films. It was usually post-production. This was tough stuff to shoot. Already had a great respect for people like Minnelli. Just couldn't seem to work it out without just putting in the multiple cameras and shooting an awful lot of film. I later realised and talked to people about this film and MGM in the old days. Everybody was on contract and they would rehearse for 2 weeks. We don't get that. We would stage it and shoot it." You can see, obviously, time constraints are a lot different. and of course, part of that was, the choreography and stuff on the setups that they had to do too. So Michael Paré later said, "You got to realize that out of the whole cast, nobody was over 30. Diane Lane was, I think, 18. It was an enormous Hollywood production. My manager had me hire a limousine to pick me up at home and take me to work. I was like, Jesus, this is incredible. This is Hollywood, the real Hollywood, the Hollywood they make movies about.
He was scary. And Walter isn't the kind of guy who works well with kids. He's a cowboy. He's like John Ford. Don't ask me how to act. I'm a director. Which is interesting, too. Rick Moranis is also another one. Pari also said he had troubles with Rick Moranis on it. Rick Moranis drove me out of my mind. There's this whole wave of insult comedy. In the real world, if someone insults you a couple of times, you can smack them or punch them. You can't do that in a movie set. And these comedians walk around and they can say whatever they want. I'm just not that handy with it. Comedians are a special breed. You can imagine too, because he's a very funny guy. Pari said the original script had his character Tom Cody kill Raven with a knife. Walter really liked the idea of, because it had Tom Cody winning at all costs. However, this was changed to a fair fight just to get the PG rating. And it's a great fight at the end, folks. You know, it's, you know, these two big poles, basically. These axe things or whatever they are. And, you know, it's got that quality. He's like a young, younger version of Nick Nolte or David Carradine. They just got that real toughness to him. And he has that in those performances and even now as well, too. Which I find really, really interesting, too. But, you know, of all of it, it worked out incredibly well, too. So the soundtrack's interesting, too. We've got, obviously, Jimmy Levine produced five of the songs for the film. And it had, basically, Evelyn's singing voice was made up from Laurie Sargent and Holly Sherwood. And basically put them back together from this, too. Two songs written by John Steinman were part of the soundtrack. Tonight is where it means what it means to be young, and Nowhere Fast as well. Both performed by Fire Incorporated, which is with Laurie Sargent and Holly Sherwood were billed as. Of course, there's even more than that. I Can Dream About You was Dan Hartman's selection of the film, and of course they had at the end of the film the Sorrells, which is a doo-wop style group consisting of the actors Snowy Jackson, Grandel Bush, McKelty Williamson, and of course Robert Townsend. And you know, it's interesting to get that sort of thing in this too. I mean, it really had that dreamy quality too. So on the soundtrack, on side A you had Nowhere Fast, Sorcerer, Deep and Deeper, Countdown to Love, and One Bad Stud. And so you had Stevie Nicks on there. You had obviously Tom Petty as well. The artist was Marian McKee. These are just the writers, folks. Dan Hartman as well. Side B had Tonight Is What It Means to Be Young, Never Be You, I Can Dream About You, Hold That Snake, and Blue Shadows as well. Really interesting too. So again, you know, this is a film which you expect to have done better than it did. I think it's still a lot better than people give it credit for. Just as we're going into the spoilery territory now of the actual story. And I've held off that too because I want you folks out there to actually go and check this film out. Because the storyline is worth it. It's very much a Western. So it's set in Richmond, a city district in a time period that resembles basically the 1950s, where Ellen Aim, lead singer of Ellen Aim and the Attackers, has been playing at a local concert in her hometown when the Bombers of this massive biker gang turn up in a part of the town called Battery, and led by Raven Shadow, played by Willem Dafoe, crashes the concert and then, of course, steals and kidnaps, like Ellen. From this, we've got Reva Cody, who then telegrams the ex-soldier brother of hers by the name of Tom Cody, played by, of course, Michael Pare, and asks him to come home. Of course, he comes home after smashing up a place, a small town of greasers, and then, of course, he steals their car and then heads home. And from here, we basically have him hooking up with a character by the name of McCoy, who is going to help him get to, obviously, take on that one as well. And of course, he talks to Ellen's manager and current boyfriend, Billy Fish, played by Rick Moranis, who's obviously wanting to come along on that one too. From here, Tom acquires a cache of weapons, a pump-action shotgun, a revolver, and a lever-action rifle. And of course, from here, it's all them versus, of course, the greasers, and of course, in this case, the Bombers. That's basically what it is. It's them hunting them down, kind of like the Searchers or something like that, folks. It's a classic Western idea, and one hell of a film. This film is a solid 5 out of 5 on, of course, the Lethal Mullet podcast. If you haven't seen it, you got to get this edition too, folks, because it is something.
Thank you for listening. We hope you're enjoying this podcast. Here are the other great shows on the Fandom Podcast Network. Culture Clash, where we discuss the latest in entertainment and pop culture. Blood of Kings, our show covering the entire Highlander universe. Couch Potato Theater, we celebrate our favorite movies. And Time Warp, our fandom flashback show discussing a year in movies and our favorite retro movie, TV, and pop culture topics. Good Evening, discussing all things Alfred Hitchcock. Hair Metal Podcast, we cover the rock metal music of the 80s and early 90s. Type 40, a Doctor Who podcast, discussing the time-traveling Doctor Who universe. Lethal Mullet, an action film podcast, covering the 80s, 90s, and beyond. Also, check out the Lethal Mullet Network for more great podcasts. What a Piece of Junk, our Star Wars podcast. Making Treks, a Star Trek podcast, with a deep dive into the final frontier. The Fandom Show, our Fandom Podcast Network live YouTube show discussing the hottest topics in fandom. The True Believers MCU Podcast, discussing the Marvel Cinematic and Television Universe. Union Federation, our Star Trek and the Orville Show. And we're proud to welcome the BQN Network to the Fandom Podcast Network. Please visit our friends on the BQN Network, a Star Trek Universe podcast that also includes your favorite topics, movies, history, superheroes, and more. You can find the Fandom Podcast Network on YouTube. The Fandom Podcast Network is also on all major podcast platforms. The Fandom Podcast Network audio master feed is on Podbean at fpnet.podbean.com. You can find the Fandom Podcast Network on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. You can email us at fandompodcastnetwork@gmail.com. Thank you so much for listening, and remember, respect others and enjoy your fandom.